Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
This is Mill Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. And this is Supreet Raju, co-founder of One Rare, a food metaverse game.
So the One Rare NFTs are basically focused on a very simple idea. How we cook at home is exactly replicated onto the blockchain. So let's say at home we're craving French fries. Now to make French fries, the most basic things we need are cooking oil, potato, and salt. In One Rare, you can simply claim the French fry NFT by collecting the ingredient NFTs of these three particular things. So you come into our food wars, you can farm for them or you can buy them from the farmer's market. And once you have the cooking oil, potato and salt, you can head to our kitchen, check out the French fry recipe, and then in your wallet, automatically these ingredients would be taken away and what you'll be left with is your French fry NFT.
That was Supreet Raju, co-founder of One Rare. So what exactly is a French fry NFT, and what does food in the metaverse really mean? So to help us better understand, I'm joined by Abigail Kaffler. She's the author of the Bustle article, How Will We Eat in the Metaverse? Abigail, welcome to Milk Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into the interesting and confusing topic of eating in the metaverse, let's define a few terms. What is a metaverse?
So the definition varies depending on who you talk to, but it's basically kind of a virtual world that has a lot of different components. So it could include virtual reality, augmented reality, and often when people are talking about it now, there's an element of cryptocurrency that people are using to participate in it. And that's kind of the digital economy of the metaverse.
Okay, so what about NFTs, you know, non-fungible tokens? I think most people know what they are, but maybe we should start with a clear definition.
Yeah, so it's a way to record who owns something virtual. So that could be, for example, an old tweet or a piece of digital art, or it could be a certificate to a specific food item, which we'll talk about. And that's something that you can trade, you can sell, and it's recorded that you're the one who purchased it.
Going through your article, it seems to me there are two categories. Mm-hmm. There's a category where the metaverse interacts with real life in some way, where you actually do get to eat a meal.
Right.
Instead of having a non-fungible token for, you know, a Singapore curry that you can't eat. Mm-hmm. And then there are versions of the metaverse that exist entirely in the metaverse with no real-world connection. And that's a theme I'd like to follow up on as we go along, because it seems to me when you connect to the real world, it seems to be more interesting to me. But in any case,
I agree.
So let's do the dinner club.
Yes.
This one has a real world connection. How does it work?
So this is called Dinner DAO. And just to define another term, a DAO is a decentralized autonomous organization. And it's an organizational model that's used a lot in this space. And what I think is interesting about this is that it's basically a supper club, except instead of, you know, Venmoing a friend or someone puts their card down to get the points, you purchase your membership in cryptocurrency. And then that amount of money that everyone puts in, I believe there are 8 slots, that's what the money that you use to buy the dinner.
Okay, let me just call this out, okay? You don't need an NFT to do this.
No.
Or a blockchain or anything else. I mean, you could just have a supper club. You could have done this using a telephone.
Right.
So why is the NFT or Discord central to this idea? It just seems like it's an old idea, a supper club, and someone's kind of making it, you know, sexy.
Absolutely. I think for a lot of the members, at least so far, they are already interested in this space. And it's a great way to meet different people. Because sometimes, let's say you start a supper club through, I don't know, alumni of a school or everyone right. who has a child at a certain school, you know, it would already be people in your network. Whereas the rule for this one is you can't invite more than one person you know in real life. So it's supposed to sort of use that like third degree network connection, which of course there are other ways to do. But I think the appeal is that it's a way to experiment with this technology in kind of a low stakes way, because you can try out new apps, you can try out new cryptocurrency, but it's only a 6-month commitment. People are paying the equivalent of about $300 for a couple dinners. It's kind of low risk.
Okay, now let's get to an example that's a bit more virtual, one rare. We heard from the co-founder, Supreet Raju, earlier about creating a French fry NFT.
Yes.
And I have to say, I just don't get this. Virtual restaurants and virtual farmers markets, could you explain this to me? Does this really have a future?
Yeah, so One Rare is kind of billed as the world's first food metaverse, and they try to really capture a lot of aspects of the food world. The restaurants will have dishes from an actual restaurant. There's a digital farmers market where there's ingredients.
Wait.
Yes.
Have dishes. These are virtual dishes.
Right, but they do correspond to actual menu items, and while it's not necessarily practical, for example, if I'm on One Rare and I purchase a dish from a chef in Singapore, you know, I'm in Brooklyn, that doesn't mean I get a free flight to go to Singapore and try it. That would be cool. But it means that theoretically, if I do go to this restaurant, I would be able to use my token to get that dish.
So, okay, so I get the token. I don't go to Singapore, right? But I have a token. What does it actually get me?
So it would be kind of added to your wallet, and it's just a way for you to appreciate a cuisine or a specific dish. You can also trade it or sell it. So perhaps there's someone that you meet in One Rare browsing the farmer's market who does live in Singapore or has plans to travel there, and then they might have something for, you know, a restaurant in the U.S. So there's that opportunity for exchange, but unless you actually show up at the restaurant, you don't get anything tangible. But I do think there's a gaming element too. So you don't have to purchase things all the time. You could also just kind of bop around and visit different areas. And, you know, the founders really want people to, one, kind of learn about global food culture. That's a big passion of theirs. And then the other thing is they want people to just learn about the blockchain and get comfortable in this space. You know, how does it work to buy something with this technology, et cetera.
Now, what about the Norwegian wine company? This one actually makes sense to me, but you want to explain how it works?
Absolutely. So Viv, which is a Norwegian wine NFT company, they work with vineyards in Europe to sell NFTs that correspond to specific wine vintages. So it's almost a pre-purchase to a specific vintage of wine, and then they securely store the wine. So again, it corresponds to real wine, and it you can trade it while it ages or eventually, you know, consume it or own it. And their big pitch was that, you know, winemaking is a super expensive endeavor. You're spending years growing the grapes, fermenting without ever seeing a dollar. And a lot of winemakers struggle to get financing from traditional banks. So this is a way that they can get funding, get capital from people who are interested, and it doesn't have the same structure or collateral requirements as, you know, a conventional loan.
Yeah, well, it provides cash flow in the early years.
Right.
And it provides something, you know, it's my bottle of wine.
Totally.
And the NFT is the perfect way to assure you that you have it. So let's back up a few layers and talk about the metaverse a bit. I guess my question is, what do you think is the primary emotional motivation of people who think that the world wants to live, at least in part, in a metaverse?
So I think it really varies. I think some people use it as kind of a get rich quick scheme or, you know, just, oh, I have to get in this gold rush. So that's not really something that compelling to me. But I do think that when people talk about, there's the phrase Web 3. So it's sort of if Web 2.0 is like you have a Facebook profile and you have your Gmail and all those things, if you look at it, that's just you're filling out a form that some company designed. Whereas all these projects are very much starting from the ground up, you get to decide which things are important to me. So I think there's a creativity that I heard about and a desire to experiment that I heard about from a lot of the people in this space, or even Dinner DAO. You know, it's a fun way to meet people. There's a low barrier to entry. And for the people who are a part of it, it's a really valuable community. So I think kind of experimentation and community are two of the driving forces from people who are active in this space.
So is there one thing in all of this you're really excited about? Where if this metaverse thing really does work out, is there something you think is really helpful to humanity in all of this?
So I spoke to Andrea Hernandez, who's a food and beverage forecaster with under the Snack Shot, and she's based in Honduras. And she was talking about how it would be really cool if NFTs, because it's harder to get traditional bank loans there, or crypto could help, let's say, farmers or agriculture workers have an ownership share of the work they're doing, right. Or similar with restaurant workers, that you have some type of equity. And I think that's a very ambitious project, and it's not going to be as lucrative, which is why fewer people are working on it. But I think just from like a worker empowerment perspective, you know, unions are obviously having a big moment. I think that's a big area of interest for the food world is, you know, labor, obviously. So if there's a way to improve working conditions via giving people some control or ownership via this technology, like, I mean, there's a lot of kinks to work out and a lot of logistics and skepticism and risk, but I think that that would be something that I would potentially be very excited about because it would just address something really urgent.
Yeah, that's interesting because stock ownership is complicated.
Right. And
this would be an easy way to bring people into ownership. Abigail, thank you so much. I'm not sure I'll be visiting the metaverse anytime soon, but maybe I should. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Abigail Koffler, author of the Bustle article, How Will We Eat in the Metaverse, and founder of the newsletter, This Needs Hot Sauce. One corner of the food metaverse that's rapidly growing is Dinner DAO. Those are supper clubs where folks organize online and then meet in real life for dinner. We spoke with one Dinner DAO member, Amber Case, who told us about the joys of eating dinner with strangers.
You know, sometimes if you're really into a specific thing, you know, maybe you go on the conference circuit and there's a speaker dinner for all the speakers. And you sit down, you get this nice free dinner, and you get to meet each other. And here are these predetermined people for you. But what about in your own city? You know, who's actually there in your city that you can meet or you didn't know? I think if you just have your friend group, it's less likely to be, you know, a totally random group of diverse people. But when you're having dinner with some strangers, I think it's really exciting because it would be very hard to do that on your own. It's just harder to do that to get outside of your social group.
That was Amber Case, a core member of Dinner DAO's Portland, Oregon chapter. Now my co-host Sarah Moult and I are ready to solve your culinary mysteries. Sarah is, of course, the author of Home Cooking 101, also star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good, Chris.
So here's the deal. I make pizza a lot. Like, and all these recipes are like, use half a teaspoon of yeast, you mix up the dough, knead it, put it in the fridge for a cold ferment for 3 days, and it's really important to develop the flavor. My deal now is, like, why not use a ton of yeast, right? I use massive amount of yeast and just do it the same day, and you get this bubbly, wonderful, lively dough, and you throw it either on the grill or you throw it in the oven, and it bubbles up, and it's got a great crust. So I'm in the massive yeast category. This whole little bit of yeast and 3 days in the fridge. I mean, I'm sorry. It's just like,
well,
come on.
I mean, I hear you. You want to know how I make my pizza dough?
You buy it from the
local
pizzeria?
No, I could never live that down. Yeah. No, heck no.
No.
I use the rapid rise yeast and I throw it in the food processor with some flour. And then you add hot water because it's rapid rise. And I add a little bit of oil for flavor, whiz it up, let it rise for an hour, and then it's good to go.
Yeah.
Boom.
Do you use a whole package?
No, you don't need to use that much more. I mean, you are looking for a particular texture.
I like bubbly.
Yeah.
Then, I want a real bubbly
crust.
Then,
go for it. Do it.
I even did one once with two packages of yeast.
You're a wild man.
I'm going to go for three next week.
Do it.
I think the American Yeast Council should
pursue this.
Absolutely hire me.
Yeah, you should lead the charge.
As a promoter.
There you go.
All right, let's take a call.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Jessica from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi, Jessica. How can we help you today?
I recently wanted to make some lavender sugar cookies for my cousin for her birthday, and I didn't like any of the cookie cutters or the stamps that I was finding. I did come across a cookie press, and so I thought, well, these shapes and designs are really cute. Let me try that. So I found out the hard way that cookie presses are made for spritz cookies. The batter is, I presume, thinner than sugar cookie batter. So I tried it with the sugar cookie batter, did not work. And so I was comparing the recipes, and I noticed that the ingredients seem to be more or less the same, just in different proportions between a spritz cookie recipe and the sugar cookie recipe. But the spritz cookie recipe had milk in it, and the sugar cookie recipe did not. And so I was wondering, can I add milk to a sugar cookie recipe so that it'll thin it out enough so that I can use a cookie press? Or is it really just a matter of the cookie press is made for spritz cookies?
I would tend to say find a good spritz recipe and then, you know, just how are you going to add the lavender to it?
It was just blend it up and mix it into the batter.
Uh-huh. I just think why try to adapt something? You said the proportions are different too, and that's relevant here also.
Yes.
Baking is pretty exact. I'm not saying you can't adjust
okay.
it, but that would be my okay. inclination. Just find a really good spritz cookie. But let's see
okay.
what Chris has to say.
I think the problem is spritz cookies have a higher proportion of fat to flour.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they have to have just the right texture to get through the little plate at the bottom, you know, when you press them through.
Mm.
And some spritz cookies have milk, some don't. So it's just
okay.
a fat to flour issue. So I totally agree with Sarah. Just get a spritz cookie. The sugar in the cookie, I would throw in a food processor and add the lavender to that and just process for about 45 seconds. And that's a good way of
okay.
distributing the lavender flavor in the cookie. But I would do spritz cookie because it's just a different animal than a sugar cookie.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So
there you go. And let us know how it goes.
All right. Absolutely.
Yeah. We like to hear back.
Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. This is Milk Street Radio. If you need help in the kitchen, give us a call anytime. The number is 855-426-9843. One more time. 855-426-9843, or simply email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Amy from Cincinnati, Ohio.
How can we help you?
Well, oh, wise ones, I have a question for you about short ribs. Bone-in short ribs are increasingly hard to find and, of course, very expensive. So when I was trying to find the 5 pounds that I needed to cook, I could come up with about 3 pounds bone-in and then an additional pound without the bone. My question is, at what point in time in the cooking, these are going to be braised in red wine, do I add the boneless pieces? The same time?
Right.
Do I wait?
I throw them at the same time. First of all, it's the internal temperature and the collagen breakdown that's going to determine the cooking time. With a
mm-hmm.
bone, it will change cooking time a little bit. But you're not dealing with you know, a large bone and a lot of meat. And so what I would do was put them in at the same time, and then I'd start checking maybe 45 minutes or half an hour before they're supposed to be done. I would just temp the boneless ones to see if they're done. If they are, you can just take them out. The other thing is, it's pretty hard to overcook short ribs. I mean, they're just going to keep getting tender. So if they get to 195 or 205 or whatever, it doesn't really matter that much.
Okay.
You can braise short ribs for an extra half hour. It's not going to hurt them. And you very often do that when you reheat them anyway. So I put them at the same time, maybe half an hour before they're supposed to be done, temp them, you know, with a fork tender. If they're fork tender, you can take them out and then finish cooking the others.
Okay.
But by the way, boneless short ribs are now, at most recent, sort of our go-to stew meat. They're really delicious. They cook up really well. You can actually cut them in smaller pieces. You can even actually stir fry it sometimes if they're small enough pieces or saute it. So it's a great cut. So, Sarah?
I agree. They are different, though. As Chris said, they're cut from the chuck or shoulder. And they're not generally as fatty as the bone-on short ribs. So there is going to be somewhat of a difference in flavor and texture between the two. I agree. Put them all in together and then just see how tender they are. The thing about the boneless ones is they don't have as much fat.
Well, that's why I like boneless, too. It's less fatty, which is really
nice.
Yeah,
except fat has flavor. You can always remove the fat later.
This is the Midwest. We're not afraid of fat.
Yeah, but if you cook a whole thing of bone and short ribs, you're going to get a ton of fat.
Of course. And then you save
it. To save it
put
off,
it in the freezer.
And you cook your potatoes.
Yes, thank you.
There we
go.
I knew you were
good idea.
Oh, dear. Okay. We can't do this anymore. I'll pretend next time I'm Chris. You pretend you're Sarah.
We know all the answers.
We do. So. Any rate, yeah.
Boneless short ribs are just a great cut.
Yeah. So.
Amy, thank you.
Okay,
yes.
Good to know. Okay, thank you. You have a great one.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Up next, a lesson in Chinese cooking from Chris Thomas and Stephanie Lee. That's coming up right after the break. Hey, Chris Kimball here asking for a favor. There's something you can do to help us out. Just leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to Milk Street Radio. Tell us and new listeners what you love about the show and why you listen every week. We'd really appreciate it. And thanks. I'm Christopher Kimball, and now here's a word from our friends at Allagash Brewing Company, who love food as much as we do here at Milk Street.
Hi, this is Jason Perkins. I'm the brewmaster at Allagash, and I've been making Allagash White in Portland, Maine since 1999. So a white beer is a very old style of beer. Traditionally, it was brewed with spices of some type, typically coriander and orange peel. And I think one of the things that makes Allagash White distinctive and different is the rare combination of complexity and drinkability. And it's sometimes remarkable to stop and realize that I never get tired of it. You know, I'll open a can or I'll pour a glass and the first sip and I'm like, man, this beer is good. There are a lot of different ways that folks can enjoy an Allagash White, and here are some of the examples of what folks here at the brewery like to do.
My favorite thing to pair with an Allagash White is simple, beautiful seared scallops over a bed of fresh greens with blood orange and shaved fennel.
My favorite would probably have to be like an Italian or a hoagie, capicola, pickled vegetables, crusty bread. It's got that nice lemony, zesty character that just gets you ready for the next bite.
The ultimate pairing for me is this dish called bosam, which is this like big pork shoulder with like salt and brown sugar. We also call it candy pork in my house, and a little like scallion ginger sauce. It's like lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, and it's just perfection.
My other top choice was like a hot dog. Like, just have a hot dog and have an Allagash White. You don't need to dress it up.
There's something about mussels with beer, especially the white, that is just so good.
I feel like it goes really well with different soft cheeses that aren't too dominant, but then also with like spicy Indian food. So I think it's just really versatile.
I could imagine like something like lemon meringue pie. That would be really nice.
Pairing Allagash White with carrot cake is a thing of beauty.
This maybe it sounds really boring, but pepperoni pizza. I feel like after a long week, having like a nice warm pepperoni pizza and a cold Allagash White is just like you made it. Like you did your week. You deserve this pizza. You deserve this beer.
It's perfect in summer. It's perfect in winter.
I haven't really found a flavor that I don't think works really well with Allagash White.
Yeah, so not only do I drink it while I cook, I often cook with it. So if I'm creating some kind of stew, I'll add a little bit of Allagash White to it.
A lot of people use Allagash White in like a fried fish batter.
Anywhere where you can add like a spritz of lemon or a spritz of lime, that could be the beer.
We are very food-minded here at Allagash, obviously. And I think because of that, Allagash White is kind of subtle in a way that not all beers are. And I think that makes it very food-friendly.
I think it tends to unlock qualities in the food that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily notice.
Like it's not too hoppy or it's not too sweet. So it sits right in the middle and sort of brings the flavors of the dish to life.
If you ask anyone here at Allagash, we're pretty much all stands for this beer. We love it so much because every time you have it, you pick up something new.
Every time you come back to it, you're reminded like, oh, wow, yeah, that's really good.
This is Jason Perkins again. Just wanted to say thanks to everyone at Allagash for sharing. You can try Allagash White at home, too. Head to allagash.com/locator to find Allagash White near you.
For 21 plus only, please drink responsibly. Allagash Brewing Company, Portland, Maine.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. In 2017, Chris Thomas and Stephanie Lee started their YouTube channel, Chinese Cooking Demystified. They travel around China in search of the best recipes and techniques, such as hot dry noodles from Wuhan and egg wrap potato from Guoyang. Chris and Stephanie, welcome to Milk Street.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Chris.
Pleasure. I love your YouTube channel. I love your work. We actually have a friend in common, Kenji Lopez-Alt. He was just telling me about your scrambled egg method, which I watched, by the way. I was really interesting because I like, we share the same kind of preferences. You like eggs that are moist, rich, and silky. I think the French refer to it as snotty eggs because they're not dry and overcooked. But could you explain how you do your eggs? It's really an interesting method.
Chris is the egg guy between us. I'll let him tell the story.
Yeah, so the specific kind of way, it's called hua dan. There's a few different approaches to it. The one that we did in our video, basically we just kind of added the eggs to like a hot wok and then waited until there's just barely bubbles forming around the edges and then just kind of scooping it up over itself. And the nice thing about hua dan is that you can put a bunch of different things in it. I believe in that video we put char siu barbecue pork in it, but you can put beef and a number of different things.
But there were two other things about it that struck me. You separate the eggs to start, and two, you use cornstarch in the mixture.
Yeah, the cornstarch thing is actually a little bit less traditional. It's a little bit of our own thing there. But yeah, the separation, especially because there's one dish called huangpu cha dan. How do you say that in Cantonese, though?
Wangbao.
Yeah, wangbao. And that one, the separation is incredibly important. It's basically a more traditional version where it's just eggs and that's about it. There's a lot of apocryphal stories about it. Some people say that you need to even whip the egg yolks so much that it basically creates stiff peaks, the point where like a pair of chopsticks can sit in it. But there's a bunch of different ways to approach that dish.
You did a wonderful video on chili oil, which just drives me insane because I get totally confused. And yeah, I think you end up with like more than a dozen bottles and explaining the different varieties. So could you just give us a short course in how to buy chili oil and what the basic differences are?
I think right now, from what I saw in supermarkets in the US, the major type are the Guizhou one, which is like the Laogama type, the Guizhou style, which is like toasted chili flakes that's fried in chili oil. Generally speaking, I would recommend sticking with like the more reputable, like tasty brands like Laogama. And another one that I've seen recently, it's called Cui Hong. That's a pretty famous brand from Sichuan that makes really decent Sichuan style pure chili oil, like the chili oil without chili flakes in it, but it's already seasoned with spices and aromatics. This will be the two major brands that I would look for at a Asian supermarket.
Let's talk about cooking rice. You have this great method. You're talking about stir-fried rice, and you talk about you don't have to refrigerate it overnight. If you steam it, you can stir-fry it right away. Could you describe that? Because that was really, really interesting.
Sure, yeah. So basically, the idea of steamed rice is that you're going to be first par cooking it. So you're basically just doing that for 3 minutes or so. And then what you'll do is you'll transfer it to a steamer and then steam it for
10
minutes. Thank you. And traditionally, what it would be is if you go to the southwest of the country where there is a little bit more of a culture of steamed rice.
The steamed rice culture remained more in southwest.
Right. So if you're going to Sichuan, let's say, oftentimes you'll walk into a restaurant and there will be these big buckets of steamed rice that you can just kind of serve yourself some rice. And there was one video where I literally just took a, you know, kind of like a mesh strainer and put the par-cooked rice in that and then just kind of like used that as a makeshift steamer, putting some right. aluminum foil on it. Also works brilliantly.
You had this wonderful, in one of your videos, you had a little shot of a New York Times recipe for stir-fried rice, and you kind of made fun of it. What was wrong with that picture? In other words, when people do stir-fried rice poorly, what are they doing wrong?
I think, how to put this. Usually it feels like the rice, it kind of looks wet. A lot of those fried rice recipes I saw, they tend to use a lot of sauces. And water makes the rice wet and clumpy. And the texture is just weird. While a lot of fried rice here in China, you don't use that much sauces, unless the sauce is like oil base. You season it mostly with like the fried rice ingredients. That's also a big part of where the flavor comes from. And you also season it with salt or some MSG or chicken bouillon powder. Like generally speaking, it's more like dry ingredients that's giving the flavor of the rice.
Now let's talk about chopsticks. You use chopsticks for almost everything in your videos. Maybe you could just give us a short lesson in cooking with chopsticks.
Yeah. Where to begin? I think we use chopsticks as whisks. We also use it quite a bit when stir frying. You know, for example, like whenever you would use a tong in like Western cooking, you can use chopsticks. And then another thing that you can do is you can use it to kind of estimate oil temperature. You know, you can basically tell more or less what the oil temperature is looking like based on the intensity of the bubbles that are coming out around the sides of the chopsticks. Cooking chopsticks are awesome.
You talk about century eggs or 100-year-old eggs. How would you use 100-year-old egg or century egg in your cooking?
Yeah, I mean, probably I would say the most classic century egg dish would be having it together with congee. So this is something that if you're in China, you can even go to KFC and for breakfast, they'll have a century egg rice congee.
Well, can I ask you about that? Because I saw that in your video. So they actually sell that at KFC?
Yeah, they do. KFC China does a very great job localizing. It's very creative. They sell like the youtiao, deep fried dough sticks. They sell Portuguese egg tart that's from Macau. They sell wraps with like the Peking duck sauce and deep fried chicken in it. It's very fun.
They should just have an Asia version of the KFC and reintroduce it back into the United States. I think you put it in like New York or LA or something. I think it'd be quite popular.
That's a good idea. Hot dry noodles. You know, what are hot dry noodles?
So hot dry noodle, dry means no soup. And you eat it while it's like really hot. So it's kind of an interesting component of characters. The noodles, because it doesn't have soup, the major flavor comes from sesame paste. In the old days, the noodles, it's mixed with sesame paste and toasted sesame oil. And nowadays, people kind of like change the toasted sesame oil into using like a master stock in flavoring it. And it's a really popular classic breakfast item in Wuhan.
You know, one of our regular contributors here at Milk Street, Alex iNews, he told me that when he researches recipes, he goes on to, you know, local internet sites from China, for example. Everything's in Chinese. And he finds this, you know, huge wealth of people demonstrating how to make, authentically make different dishes. And he said, now that's really, this is his primary source of research. Is this the same type of thing you guys use when investigating a recipe?
Yeah, of course. Especially in recent years, there's this boom in Chinese internet that's like people in the village would start filming cell phone videos of them just cooking their daily stuff. And I love binging these videos. It's like real village life. And you don't necessarily like research a certain specific dish. It's just, for me at least, I like to immerse myself into watching people from different areas cook.
Yeah. You know, we kind of talk about like, yeah, maybe researching really shouldn't be that hard. All you really need to do is you Google the dish name, you go to Wikipedia, you find the name of the dish in the local language, then you just go to YouTube, copy paste, and then you have all of these people that are just making it. And, you know, at a very quick glance, you can kind of see the real deal of like how it's made.
So last thing, is there something you could suggest that everybody here at home could include and make part of their regular repertoire?
So I think not necessarily dish per se, but just think of it as like a formula. That's how I learned to cook growing up, watching my parents, because like they both work and they are busy. And one really quick formula that we almost eat every day, it's basically you have some vegetable components, let's say pepper or onion or broccoli or gailan, like the Chinese broccoli. You prep them on the side and you have some meat components like pork slivers or chicken pieces. You marinate it. And what you do is you fry the meat first separately and take it out. And then you just toss your vegetables in and fry your vegetable components. And when the vegetables are done, toss your meat back in. That is a very useful stir-fry formula, I'll say. You can just mix and match anything you want.
Guys, thank you very much, Chris and Stephanie. I love your work. I love your YouTube channel. And I love the fact that we really learn a different way to think about cooking. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
That was Chris Thomas and Stephanie Lee. Their YouTube channel is called Chinese Cooking Demystified. KFC has over 8,000 outlets in China, more than double McDonald's. Its success is based on adapting food to the local culture. So for breakfast, you can order minced pork congee with preserved egg, beef and egg oatmeal, or mushroom chicken porridge. Or you might want to try the Six Gods Flower Dew Coffee, which is inspired by a famous mosquito repellent that has a strong mint and floral aroma. One day, I expect, KFC will adapt its menus here in the States to reflect its experience abroad, much like Pidgin English eventually changed how foreigners spoke back home. Many expressions, including long time no see, are actually based on Mandarin. Both language and food cut both ways. What is imported gets adapted and then exported back to where it came from. Now that's real cultural exchange. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Here's J.M. Hirsch with this week's recipe, Mexican-style corn with chili and lime. JM, how are you?
I'm doing great.
So I went to Oaxaca, then I went to Mexico City, and then you went to Mexico City, and then I guess you'll go to Oaxaca, right? So we'll both go to the same place. But we both ate a lot of street food. I had my favorites. You had your favorites. Tell me about the thing you love the most.
As you know, when you travel, you just stumble upon things, and suddenly your eyes open, and the world reveals itself to you in a new and delicious way. And that's what happened with this dish. Walking down the street, this guy shoves a cup of something at me, and it was yellow and it was white, and I wasn't sure what it was. Well, it turns out it's esquites, which is a form of Mexican street corn, which the corn has been grilled usually or roasted, and then the kernels cut off the cobs, and simmered with herbs and lime juice and chilies and cotija, which is a salty Mexican cheese, and crema, which is kind of like a Mexican sour cream, and for a creamier touch and a slightly sweet and tangy touch, mayonnaise. And I was not expecting to love it the way I did, but when I tasted it, I gotta say, I was blown away because it hit every single flavor note that I crave. It was sweet, it was creamy, it was savory, it was herbal, it was spicy. It was everything. And you just eat it by the spoon out of these plastic cups standing on the side of the road. And like I say, I did not expect to love it as much as I did because it seemed kind of so simple and unexpected, but it was one of the favorite things I ate on this trip.
Is this one of those recipes that makes sense from a cart on the side of the road, but makes absolutely no sense when you do it at home?
You know, I don't think so, because here in New England, we get great corn in the summer, and all you do is cut the kernels off the cob, and you simmer them with some lime juice and some herbs, and then you throw in your cayenne pepper and your sour cream and your chilies, and pretty soon, you have an amazing way of eating fresh corn. And you can actually do it with frozen corn out of season, but when corn is in season, it's so much better. And it's just such a fun, simple, and really delicious way to appreciate fresh corn. Yes, if you are eating it on the side of the road in Mexico City, it will taste better just because of where you are and the experience, but you're also going to love it at home.
So I do have one question, which is Mexican corn, in my experience, is a little starchier than sweet corn in America. Does that change the balance of flavors at all?
You know, they were using a sweet corn for this every time I had it. And so, you know, you're right. You know, Mexican corn tends to be a lot starchier. This tended to be a much sweeter side of their corn, which does tend to be starchier than ours, but not so much so that I noticed it in this recipe.
So you went to Mexico City. You liked the tacos, but you loved the esquites, which is corn with crema and mayonnaise and cotija cheese and lime juice, and just sounds absolutely fabulous. Thank you, JM.
Thank you. You can get this recipe for Mexican-style corn with chili and lime at milkstreetradio.com.
This is Milk Street Radio. Coming up, Adam Gopnik cries tears of joy for seafood in Venice, as well as breakfast in New York. We'll be right back.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. It's time to take a few more calls with Sarah.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Steve. I'm calling from Somerville, South Carolina.
Hi, Steve. How can we help you today?
Well, I've developed kind of a baking habit, and lately the people for whom I bake have decided they'd like me to try making things that don't have wheat flour in them anymore, that don't want the gluten. And I've been experimenting with oat flour that I make by spinning rolled oats in my food processor. And in cookies, that seems to work okay. But in other things like brownies, there's a distinct graininess that is not pleasant. And I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions on how to not have that be a problem.
You grind up your own oats, did you say?
Yeah, I'm just buying like Quaker oats and spinning them in my food processor. And I've tried doing it in a blender as well, and that doesn't seem to do any better.
What kind of blender do you have?
It's an old Hamilton Beach.
Yeah. Here's the problem. You need the sort of blender that really would make a milkshake out of me. They're high speed. They cost about $300-$400, I'm sorry to say. But they really, that's the kind of blender you need. Or you could just buy oat flour.
Ah.
The problem is it's just not fine enough because you don't have the right tool. Chris, any thoughts?
Oats have those little gnarly bits. I mean, commercial oat flour will be significantly finer and better. I would also strongly recommend almond flour, which I keep in my refrigerator all the time. It makes great cakes. There's a Spanish almond cake I make like once a month. It's got a great flavor, you know, and there's lots of gluten-free recipes that are based on almond flour. So if I was going to pick one flour that doesn't have gluten, I would pick almond flour.
But you would buy it. You wouldn't make it.
Yeah, you buy it, and there's plenty. You can actually, there's a lot of, you know, companies out there that make all sorts of flour. Sometimes using almond flour tastes better than just using all-purpose
particularly
flour.
Particularly in a brownie. I think it'd be delicious.
Yeah, that would be my recommendation.
Yeah.
And do you just substitute it one-to-one?
I don't think so. I think you need to use a recipe that calls for almond flour, oat flour. You know, if you want to substitute, then you have to get a gluten-free mixture, which has cornstarch in it, or potato starch, and white rice ground up, and brown rice ground up. It has lots of things in it. There are plenty of recipes out there, especially, you know, in the Middle East and other places, almond flour is used all the time.
The thing about almond flour, though, is, again, I wouldn't make my own almond flour because you tend to end up with almond butter. And it sounds like maybe you'd need to buy the oat flour. But I would use a recipe that was designed to be gluten-free, not try to adapt a recipe.
Yeah, I agree.
Perfect.
Okay.
Steve,
I
thank you.
Appreciate it. I'll go try and find that. Thank you.
All bye right. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Welcome to Mill Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Suzanne from Philadelphia.
How can we help you?
So I have a question about the best way to cook eggplant at home. It's one of my favorite vegetables, and I feel like every time I go to a restaurant, I have this delicious eggplant that's like charred skin, it's silky, smoky meat. But then when I'm making it at home, it's always kind of dry, tough. I can't get that like good flavor.
How are you cooking it at home?
I usually try to roast it, and then I never know, should I like press it, or I feel like it just like sops up the oil.
Are you roasting it whole, or are you cutting it into?
No, I'm usually cutting it into little chunks.
The easiest way to do it is to roast it whole, and I put it on a grill, sort of medium heat, but you just cook it to death until it looks like it collapses on itself. I mean, it looks like it's...
like a balloon that's deflated.
It looks like you really overcooked it. It looks gnarly.
Okay.
And you let it cool, and then you can slice it in half and scoop out. And it should be, like good baba ganoush, it's going to be very loose and creamy. And then I love to put tahini in it is really good. Pomegranate molasses is really good with it. Herbs in it, you know, whatever. But it's, you just have to cook it to death, essentially.
If you're doing that in the oven, at what temperature would you do that at?
I do it probably 425. I do it on a rack over a baking sheet, probably.
Okay.
Another thing you could do if you don't want to do it whole is to have it lengthwise and then score it. And then
You can do that too.
Sear it. You can sort of treat it like meat where you do the reverse sear or you sear first.
Right.
So you either cook it lower and get it really, really soft and then run it under the broiler, or you sear it maybe even on top of the stove, cut side down, and then finish it in the oven low and slow. You know, let it totally melt and get tender.
It's one of the great ingredients.
Yeah, I love it whenever I go out, and every time I try it at home, it's not, but I've never cooked it this way. I will definitely try those two ways.
Great.
Yeah, cook it till it's ugly.
Yeah.
That's it.
Thanks, Suzanne.
Thanks for calling.
Perfect.
All right. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Bye.
Okay, bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. If you need help with dinner, give us a ring, 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843, or simply email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Molly.
Hi, Molly. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Ireland.
What? Where in Ireland?
Yeah, West Cork.
Oh, wow. How can we help you today?
I've really gotten into the fermentation lifestyle. And one of the things that I've been doing is culturing and making my own butter.
Wow.
Which has been really fun. Yeah. The benefit of that is the buttermilk that you get. My question is, how do you know when buttermilk's actually gone bad, especially cultured buttermilk?
Good point.
Well, let's start at the top. Can you explain to us what cultured butter is, you know, the process?
Yeah. So you just take regular cream and then you put a dollop of yogurt in it. That's typically what I do. And then I leave it out until it's all very thick. And then I put it in the refrigerator and then I whip it into butter.
And then you whip the heck out of it until it separates into butter and buttermilk. You know, it's very tangy. It's quite acidic because you have already put culture into the original cream. I guess it would keep in the fridge 2 to 3 weeks. I think you might even be able to freeze it.
Okay, yeah.
And how do you know it's bad? I really believe it will let you know. But let's see what Mr. Kimball has to say.
Well, it's not me. It's J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, a friend of ours, did a piece in the New York Times 4 or 5 months ago. And it was all about expiration dates. And he said they're all bogus.
Yeah.
And he eats things way past the expiration date. Because the expiration date, there's a lot of reasons for those dates, but they have little to do when things actually are not edible. So I think Sarah's right. People say, you know, a couple of weeks in the fridge. But my guess is you're probably good for a month.
I'm a brave eater. You know, I'm all about, like, scrape off the mold and call it good.
Carry on.
So, yeah. But then I was like, gosh, you know, I just don't even know when this would be bad. So.
No, it's a good question because, you know, how can you tell when something that's naturally sour, because sourness would obviously be a test of something being past its expiration date.
I think it would smell funky. That's what I think.
Okay.
I mean, not just sour. I don't know, Chris. What do you think?
Well, funky's in.
Yeah.
What's wrong with funky?
No, but you know what I mean.
I'd say at least a couple of weeks. Yeah, at least.
I'd say 3 weeks.
So freezing is possible?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I think you could freeze it for a few months.
Yeah, I think it'd be fine.
Oh, super. That's great.
Now I want to make cultured butter.
It's so
fun.
Yeah.
Sarah, you could get a butter cart on like 26th Street in New York and just sell butter.
I know. I'll put a little bonnet on or something.
Excellent.
Anyway, Molly, thank you so much.
Well, thank you guys.
Yeah. Yes.
Take care.
Bye. I will. Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. Right now, let's talk to Adam Gopnik about what's on his mind this week. Adam, what's up this week?
Well, I have been thinking about and, in fact, participating in that extraordinary human emotion that we call crying for joy. When we cry for joy, it's the best kind of crying we do. In fact, it may be the most joyful kind of joy we ever possess. And I have been thinking lately, Chris, about when we cry for joy in the presence of food. Hmm. I should add immediately that I am not an easy crier. I can sit dry-eyed through Little Women or A Christmas Carol without any difficulty. But not very long ago, I was in Venice, and I went to the fish market, the famous Mercato, mm-hmm. near the Rialto Bridge. And seeing the tiny little vongole and the rich calamari and the countless kinds of shrimp and the bright, deep red tuna, I found tears coming to my eyes. I began to cry for joy at the presence of all that beautiful fish. Do you remember Daisy Buchanan in The Great Gatsby?
Yes, I do.
Cries for joy at the presence of Gatsby's beautiful shirts.
Yes.
Well, that's exactly how I felt about all that Adriatic seafood. And I bought the vongole, and I took them back to our little apartment, and I made a linguine alla vongole for my wife and a friend. I was so overcome, literally overcome with emotion. And I began to think, Chris, about other times in my life when I've had that rare and special emotion of crying for joy in the presence of food. And the first one I thought of was on my very first trip to Paris with my wife. And we had gone to a little bistro called Chez André and had ordered a champagne framboise. And the waitress absentmindedly poured the champagne with one hand and the raspberry liqueur, the framboise, with the other hand, getting in just the right amount of framboise and just the right amount of champagne, and just kind of shoved it at us. And tears came to my eyes at the casual beauty of what she'd done. And then when I tried to think of a third instance of this, I remembered coming back from a trip to Paris one summer and going out with my then young, now fully grown son, Luke, at 6 a.m. to get a New York City coffee shop breakfast at my favorite coffee shop and ordering the usual eggs and bacon and potatoes O'Brien, you know, those good coffee shop potatoes, and coffee and rye toast, and having exactly the same emotion of being overwhelmed, crying for joy at the presence of that good breakfast. And so I've tried to think to myself, what do these three things have in common that would bring such emotion to my heart? And I realized, I think, Chris, that each of these things managed to make the rhapsodic routine. They take something that is in itself amazing, the beautiful history of fish in Venice, or the Parisian combination of sobriety and efficiency, or simply the wonderful American abundance of the coffee shop breakfast. And instead of celebrating them, they just sort of shrugged at them. And then it occurred to me that that's exactly when our feelings are most moved, even those of us who are not easy criers. The best tears sneak up on us from behind.
Well, I would say one other thing, which is similar to what you said. I think when you discover perfection in the ordinary, all of a sudden you find the sublime where you don't expect to find it. And you go like, wow, there's something mercurial and wonderful about this thing in a very plain setting. And maybe that applies to many more things in life than food.
I think it does. And it isn't the normal emotion or one of the normal emotions that we get through the joys of cooking. It isn't the sense of satisfaction or generosity, sharing all of those positive emotions. It's the thing that sneaks up on us and says, wow, this is really extraordinary and nobody is making a fuss about it.
I would argue that the things that one thinks should be extraordinary in life never are. Mm-hmm. And the ordinary things in life are actually the extraordinary things.
That's exactly right. We went to some nice restaurants in Venice, and I was glad to be there. But I wasn't moved seeing all of that beautiful fish laid out casually across all of those countless slabs and counters. That was the overwhelming emotion. It wasn't the one we're prepared for. The ones we're prepared for always underwhelm us a little bit. It's the ones we're unprepared for that hit us like a wave.
So to discover the incredible lightness of being, go to your local coffee shop.
Or keep your heart and mind open. It's the reason to travel. It's the reason to do new things. You never know when that moment is going to sneak up on you. You never know when you'll be knocked sideways by the ordinary.
Knocked sideways by the ordinary. Well said. Thank you, Adam.
Pleasure talking, as always.
That was Adam Gopnik, staff writer at The New Yorker. That's it for this week's show. You can find every single one of our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, MilkStreetRadio.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can learn more about us here at Milk Street. Just go to 177MilkStreet.com. There you can download each week's recipe, watch our television show, learn about our magazine and latest cookbook, The World in a Skillet. We're on Facebook at Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, on Instagram and Twitter at 177MilkStreet. We'll be back next week, and thanks, as always, for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with GBH. Co-founder Melissa Baldino. Executive producer Annie Sinzabaugh. Senior editor Melissa Allison. Producer Sarah Clapp. Assistant producer Caroline Davis, with production help from Debbie Paddock. Additional editing by Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Chewbop Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.